And it hits me, oh my gosh, this is that triangle.
You know, there's explanation for everything that occurred in the Rendlesham Forest incident that doesn't involve aliens at all.
It was completely silent. It comes right over our heads.
He saw a classic flying saucer, really, standing in a clearing.
He turned over to my father and held his hand, and he looked in his eyes and he said, "We're not alone."
Welcome to Podcast UFO for our live show. We're live every Wednesday at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on the Dark Matter Radio Network. Please remember to visit the website podcastufo.com for past episodes, blogs, and forums. During the show, feel free to participate live in our chat room. And don't forget to like us on our very active Facebook page.
Well, hello and welcome to the show. I'm Martin Willis, your host. We have another great show for you tonight. Andy Fleming is coming up in a minute with a segment called The Lives of Stars. Not stars, or there's some show like that. Had to do with TV stars, I think. Anyway, our guest tonight is Christopher O'Brien, and we're talking cattle mutilations. You may ask, why are we talking mutilations on a UFO show? Well, there seems to be a possible tie-in with some of the theories involving UFOs, of course. Also, it seems to me that a lot of people that are interested in UFOs are also interested in mutilations. I might be wrong on that. I've seen kind of a parallel there. For our regular listeners, you know I almost hardly ever, never mention anything to do about helping out with the show, but I'm going to bring it up now. We'd really like to keep this show commercial-free. So if you would like to help us out, there is a subscribe button on podcastufo.com. It's on our website sidebar, just below the chat room, which I hope you're signing up on. A lot of work does go into these shows and a lot of dedication as well. And I really can't keep going like this, so I'd really like some help, or I'm going to have to look at some commercials. Either way, one or the other. There are subscription options, 1, 2, or 3. One is just $5 a month. Think of it as equal to a Starbucks venti size coffee, maybe. Maybe it's a little more. There's also a $10 a month donation and a $25 a month subscription as well. And keep in mind, if you ever fall out of love with me or the show, you can cancel very easily on that. And our blog pages and other pages, we have a one-time donation button. So if you'd like to do it that way, I'd appreciate that. And I want to say I do appreciate all who listen, whether you can help out or not. And feedback is always welcome. If you'd like to write me an email, it is martin@podcastufo.com. Just remember, please keep your emails as short as my attention span. And speaking of emails, I got a couple of emails this week from people asking me if I am watching the new Cosmos series with Neil deGrasse Tyson. The answer is sadly no. I'm working on a major project that's totally unrelated to UFOs. Well, eventually it might happen. Maybe I'll just say a little sneak of what I'm doing. I'm working on my new abode, and there's also a conference center on the property. It's a real cool property. It even has an observation deck, and so eventually I'm thinking maybe a UFO conference. It's on top of a mountain. There's absolutely no light pollution up there, too. It's a really great place. So that may come in the future. It needs a lot of work, a couple of years worth of work. I have no time to watch anything like getting back to Cosmos. And I do like Tyson, by the way. I think he does a great job. However, I do have one little issue, and that's I have a hard time watching him because he's always doing these weird things with his hands when he talks. Does anyone else notice this? Is it just me? You can look at my show notes, and I have a GIF up there of someone else must have caught on to it. And now I'm probably going to ruin it for all the people who watch the show, because now instead of watching the show, you're totally going to focus on his hands. Well, that's it for me right now, and we'll be back right after this clip with Andy Fleming. And we'll be back with our guest, Christopher O'Brien. Hang in and take a listen.
Hi, Martin and listeners. Now, stars don't live forever. And in an epic tale to rival the best Shakespearean tragedy,
Our sun will one day die, and with it all life on the Earth. 5 billion years from now, when our planet has been incinerated to a crisp, our local star will have run out of the hydrogen fuel that powers its nuclear fusion reactions. It will have metamorphosed from the relatively stable yellow dwarf star that we see today into a bloated, angry red giant, its outer layers and atmosphere occupying most of the inner solar system. Indeed, the sun is already imperceptibly increasing in temperature. It's 20% hotter now than when the Earth coalesced out of the sun's protoplanetary disk 4.5 billion years ago. And within a couple of 100 million years, the Earth will become uninhabitable. This chain of events is inevitable, and over different time periods, depending on their mass, happens to all stars. Stars coalesce by gravity out of clouds of interstellar gas, which consist mainly of the original constituent chemical elements of the universe, approximately 75% hydrogen and 25% helium. Gravity contracts the protostar to the point where pressure and temperature dictate that nuclear fusion starts and the star begins to shine. A small amount of mass is converted in this process into energy, under Einstein's famous equation E equals mc squared, of course. A hydrostatic equilibrium is achieved, whereby the gravity of the star is counterbalanced by the pressure of radiation and light from the nuclear reactions within its core. At this stage, the star gives the appearance of stability in terms of shape and size. In truth, however, it is a magnetically contorted and tortured object, erupting frequently and spewing out solar flares, charged particles such as protons, and coronal mass ejections. Now, stars the mass of the Sun will be in this hydrostatic equilibrium phase for about 10 billion years, but all the while the concentration of helium in their cores continues to increase. As it does so, the star begins to contract to maintain hydrostatic equilibrium, and temperatures in the core gradually increase over billions of years. Finally, when the star's nuclear fuel is exhausted, gravity exceeds radiation pressure, and the core contracts much further until spiraling temperatures and pressures succeed in igniting helium, which is then fused and transmuted into carbon. In a star with the mass of the Sun, the loosely gravitationally bound outer layers are puffed out, and the star becomes a red giant. Gravity has won, and the Sun will end its days as a white dwarf, a truly bizarre object, a star of diamond, a dense hot carbon star the size of the Earth, but with the mass of the Sun. Stars much larger than the Sun will detonate and end their days as either black holes that we've talked about in the previous two episodes, neutron stars, pulsars, or supernovae. It is these stars that we can thank for creating all of the heavy chemical elements in the universe. Elements such as iron, copper, silver, gold, lead, right up to the heaviest natural element of them all, uranium. You see, we're all children of the stars, whether it's the calcium in our bones, the iron in our blood, or the carbon in every cell of our bodies. We were all, quite literally, made in heaven. As Carl Sagan eloquently said, we are star stuff harvesting starlight. What a spiritually uplifting thought.
Well, yes, as always, thank you, Andy. And one of my favorite Carl Sagan sayings is, quote, "If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent the universe," unquote. Always love that one. Our guest has just joined us, Christopher O'Brien. How you doing?
Pretty good. Sorry about that. I guess we didn't have the right Skype connections set up on my end, but I'm glad I'm able to get through.
Yes, I am glad too. You know, I was thinking it was the I had a mix-up with a past guest due to the daylight savings time. When it switches some places, it doesn't switch other places. And that's what I was thinking happened. So,
I'm here. I'm all bright-eyed and bushy-tailed as usual.
Yes, great. So thanks for joining us. And that was very nice of you to pass along your book to me. Unfortunately, I was mentioning earlier, I'm in the middle of a major project and day and night. And I'll tell you what, I hit the sheets at night and I'm out. So I did get a chance to skim through. And this is actually a topic that's been fascinating me for a long time. I thought about asking Linda Moulton Howe on, she did early what I think is good work. But I'd like to talk to you perhaps a little bit about that, because I believe there were some things that were missed. That was quite a while ago. And also the area where you were exploring out there is a very active and strange area. And first of all, before we go into anything to do with the mutilations at all, why do you suppose that is such a paranormal area?
Well, I think the Four Corners area of the country probably has some of the more intense and intriguing hotspot zones, if you will. And the particular area that I cut my teeth on and sunk my teeth into as an investigator, the San Luis Valley in south central Colorado, extending down into, just barely down into north central New Mexico. This particular area is very, very unique, and it has quite a history with the indigenous population of strange events, of being a sacred area that's held sacred, of in one tradition, there's mention of some sort of dimensional-type doorway that may move about in the Sangre de Cristo Mountains, which make up the eastern side of the San Luis Valley, and It just has a melting pot of just inexplicable categories of the unusual. Everything from trooping fairies, brujos in training, elk hunting, seeing a leprechaun, NORAD calling the local sheriff because of a flight of what appeared to be UFOs went down, Bigfoot sightings, a platypus found at 11,000 feet in High Mountain Lake. The stories just go. That's why I wrote three books about my work. Is once you start digging into a particular hotspot area like the San Luis Valley, it's amazing the amount of the width and breadth and depth of material that you're able to uncover. And the San Luis Valley is, I think, very, very key. It's the largest alpine valley in the world. It's completely surrounded by mountains. It's a perfect sociological petri dish. And what I set out to do in 1993 is study everything that was unexplained that happened in this area, whether it be strange weather, aberrant social behavior, ritual occult crime, cryptozoological creatures, Native American legends. I mean, you can just go down the list of things, and unfortunately, the cattle mutilation phenomenon is pretty high up on the list, being the birthplace of the publicized portion of kind of the Kenneth Arnold of mutilations happened in 67 in the San Luis Valley. So that's kind of what my book's about.
Now, it goes back to, wasn't there something like Snippy the Horse or something like that was
correct
a big story? When was that, like the early 1900s or something like that?
No, the Snippy the Horse case occurred on September 7th, 1967.
Oh, okay.
In my book, I do go back in time all the way to the 1600s and look at some form of documentation that would indicate that this phenomenon has been going on for hundreds, possibly thousands of years. But the Snippy case was really important because it was the first internationally recognized case of this type. Even though it was a horse, not a cow or a bull, we've never had another case exactly like it. But what makes this case important and how it stands, kind of head and shoulders above most cases, is that it was the first international news story that covered this particular horrific mystery. The ranch owner and the owner of the horse, they got calls from China, from France, from Australia, from England, South America, This became a really big news story in 67. And I've often compared it to kind of a Typhoid Mary in terms of the creation of a cultural meme. A meme is to culture what a gene is to biology. And we have the start of a very rich cultural meme with the Snippy case.
Before we move on, what on earth are trooping fairies?
Trooping fairies are little fairies that line up in a line and troop through your room, across the countryside, whatever. I have a very, very head-scratching case reported by a who's who musician, inventor of the electronic guitar, 600 film and TV and movie credits to his name, played the theme on Star Trek and The Twilight Zone. I mean, a real name person, not just some survivalist sitting out in a trailer somewhere. This guy is, a very well-known musician and inventor. And he happened to live in a spot in the San Luis Valley, quite near where I lived, actually, that featured all kinds of, unusual phenomena, for lack of a better term, undulating forms that look like sea slugs swimming through the air. I called them prairie dragons, for lack of a better term. And instances of these like little diminutive foot high forms trooping in a line right in front of him through a studio, in through a closed door and out through a wall. And, when someone, of that stature calls you and reports something like this, after much consternation, as I found out, his family was very against him mentioning this stuff to me, but he felt that it was important enough for me to know about it. And how many other places are there in North America where you can have trooping fairies and these weird cheap firework type aerial phenomena that are routinely reported there, or these undulating sea slugs swimming through the air with law enforcement, as many as four or five people seeing them in one given area. I was very, very jazzed when I first started investigating in the San Luis Valley in the early 90s. And, obviously my enthusiasm was tempered, and I really started to try to come up with rational explanations to explain things, really get myself up to speed and as best I could as an amateur in very scientific disciplines, working with ex-law enforcement, ex-military observers, current law enforcement, academics in the sociology and departments at the local college. And I really made an attempt to dispassionately and objectively document the many things that were and probably always have been reported in the San Luis Valley.
Would there have any mushrooms growing there? I hope you have a sense of humor.
Well, I looked and was never able to find any.
Okay, good. Hey, getting back to the main topic.
I will take that as a joke.
Good. Your book is called Stalking the Herd, and it was a book you put together over several months and a lot of years of research. And let me just ask you, this is such a unusual phenomena, and there are so many different theories. We posted on our Facebook page, or I should say Peggy posted on her Facebook page, she's an admin there, something about what do you think cattle mutilations were. And there are some people adamantly saying, oh, it's the military, and it's this and it's that, and UFOs and aliens, and there's so many different theories, and there's so many holes that can be poked through most of the theories. What did you come up with when you were doing this book? What, you know what? I'm going to ask you straight out. What do you think it is?
Well, that's the $64,000 question, isn't it? I really don't have an answer that I could, take to the National Press Club and trumpet as the end-all, be-all answer. I don't think there is a single one-size-fits-all answer. I don't think it's all ETs. I don't think it's all the government. I don't think it's all misidentified scavenger action that appears strange to people that don't know what they're looking at. I don't think it's occultists. I don't think it's whatever theory you want to look at, there is no one theory that explains it all. So what I'm left with is a multi-tiered, multiple agenda, multiple players dovetailing their particular agenda either by design or just inadvertently on top of other agendas. I think there's also the high likelihood in some regions where these cases have been reported that you have societal and political manipulation going on. Rich ranchers trying to intimidate smaller ranchers who won't sell their land for the expanding big ranch, let's say.
Has there been, before you move on, has there been any links that would kind of, you know, document that?
Yeah, there have. I have two county sheriffs that have gone on the record and stated that they felt that certain helicopter teams that were associated with particular outbreaks of mutilations were actually landing and taking off from a particular ranch. And they both publicly gone on the record and said this particular rancher was somehow involved, either directly or aided and abetted some of these teams that were seen flying around areas where livestock were being discovered mutilated. So we do have some evidence that there is some societal and political manipulation going on. But again, this is not a one-size-fits-all scenario. I can't say that all mutilations would fall within that particular, you know, example. There's just too many thousands of them spread all around the world in Christian countries, I should add. This is specifically and predominantly a Christian country phenomenon. So you really do have quite a Gordian knot. And one of the reasons why I decided to subtitle Stalking the Herd with Unraveling the Cattle Mutilation Mystery is it is a real conundrum. There's many dark alleys that you go down and end up being cul-de-sacs. There's very fruitful avenues of investigative and research work that would suggest that this thing has kind of evolved over the decades. And perhaps what was really important for the perpetrators in the 70s may have become less important now in some sense. And maybe other types of programs are being perpetrated in, you know, the small ranches of America. You know, we're really jumping ahead of ourselves here. I'm not even sure, Marty, if your listeners even know what a cattle mutilation is.
I'm sure they do, but you're right.
Well,
you're right.
You know, I'm trying to shoot for the, you know, the middle here. This
well,
is a very complicated subject.
We can go.
The book is 600 pages, and it's not by accident.
That's true. Now, I know, and there's other animals involved, not just cattle. There's, you know, from everything you can think of. But we can talk a little bit about what mutilations are. But one of the things, you know, before I lose track of my thought here is, you know, they say, for instance, the government is doing research on cows. They want to find out what type of, you know, affects nuclear, atomic, what am I trying to say?
Well, the effects
radiation,
of radiation in the environment.
Yeah, of the environment. And if they took them away, that would be stealing them, so they leave them. And on and on and on. You hear all these things, but sure, I just wanted to get that out. So I want that to be a topic. But I also would like for you to explain what people, you know, what are the farmers finding on their land? They're finding a cow, I think you said, on a porch at one time. They're finding them mutilated. Some people are saying laser cuts. Some people are saying, you know.
Yeah, that's a misnomer.
Oh, okay. Go ahead.
Well, you know, there are a lot of popular misconceptions about this particular mystery. You know, I've been involved in this for over 20 years. I've personally been involved in either personally investigating or researching cases that I haven't seen. But they amount to about 200 cases overall. And there is a lot of misconceptions out there in the public about this particular mystery. One of those is the burnt laser cut scenario. In my estimation, very, very few cases have been proven to have had some sort of heat or lasing or particle beam sci-fi type a cutting agent that has heated up the hemoglobin, cooked the hemoglobin, cauterized the wounds There have been several scientific papers that have been done, most notably the National Institute for Discovery Sciences did some tests with dead cows and actually watched the process and documented the process of what happens to the actual hide that has had the organ taken out. What happens to the remaining hide? And what happens basically is the animal bloats and stretches. It stretches the incision. When the animal goes back to its normal size or deflates even, the actual incision area doesn't fully retard itself back to its original shape. What happens is the edge dries out. You have a kind of a slick, glossy appearing edge to it that turns brown. And to someone who's not a veterinary pathologist, like me, I'm not a veterinary pathologist, but to someone who doesn't know what they're looking at, it appears like it's been burned. But it's actually the natural process of the hide, the area that's been cut, probably by a sharp implement or torn out by a scavenger, that particular incision line appears brown and smooth and like it's been burnt. And unless you actually take the animal, do a complete necropsy, have a professional veterinary pathologist involved or, you know, a veterinarian that has some pathology experience, you're not going to be able to actually determine what caused the cutting action or how that cutting action can look one way and not another way. There's a lot of environmental concerns, humidity, temperature. And to the untrained eye, if he reads an article in the newspaper that there's cattle mutilations, he goes out and happens to see a cow that's been, let's say, scavenged, but in an unusual fashion. Usually the organs that the mutilators take are the same organs that scavengers normally take, the soft tissue organs, reproductive tract, an eye, oftentimes a tongue with the mandible flesh being exposed, taken away, exposing the jawbone, a plug taken out of the reproductive tract, the genitalia are gone. When you look at the edges, if that animal is bloated and dried out and then shrunk back down, it can look like it's burnt. Most of the cases that I felt were high strange, in other words, somebody came and did this to that animal, the vast majority, 90% or more, it appeared to be a sharp cutting implement, like a scalpel, a buck knife, some very, very sharp piece of steel.
Well, you know, there's never – well, before I ask this question, if you're listening live, please jump over to podcastufo.com. Join in on our chat room. It's a 1-2 click. You're in, and you can ask our guest tonight a question or two, and I'll relay it on to him. When you're talking about these cuts – it's like someone would go up to the animal. First of all, they'd have to kill it or knock it down. But a lot of times they say there's no tire tracks, there's no sign of footprints.
Correct. Most of the time.
Most of the time. So what is doing this? You know, I mean.
Well, it appears to be, Marty, and I think this is fairly simple. You mentioned earlier that these animals are left behind so that they wouldn't be stolen and then reported, you know, as some sort of criminal mischief, larceny, whatever. By leaving the animal back, it gives you plausible deniability. However, sometimes they mess up and they leave the animal in the wrong pasture. We have quite a number of cases, which I detail in the book, where animals are found in the wrong pasture, even as far as 2-3 miles away. We've had cases where the animal is not left back in the pasture and is dumped on a porch for some reason or inside an abandoned adobe shack in one case. Basically what they're doing is they're, at least in my appraisal here, I don't know this for sure, but it seems to me as if these animals are being taken, they're being experimented upon or they do have their way with the animal. And then when they drop it back, they don't drop it from where they took it. They drop it in another part of the pasture. So when the rancher goes out there and looks at the animal and he looks around for clues, oftentimes he won't even find the animal's own tracks. And so if you leave it in a slightly different place in the same pasture, you have that mystery of no tracks, no crime scene evidence, because the animal was actually taken or possibly even experimented on in another part of the pasture. So it appears to me they're being taken somewhere, they're being worked on, and then brought back and left in a different spot.
You know, I don't know if you read the Skinwalker Ranch book.
I was the first investigator up at the Sherman Ranch.
Oh, you were. Now, there was a case there where one had dropped inside of a hole, like, head first. Like, it was just, say, like it was dangling from, say, a helicopter.
No, that was last fall in Nebraska. No, the case on the Sherman Ranch was a calf that was torn apart, and the parts were that remained were laid carefully back, almost ritualistically. And this all took place within minutes while the rancher and his wife were in the same field during in broad daylight.
Wow. Wow, that there was some bizarre stuff going
on. The Nebraska case is the one that the cow was found with its head in the hole. I don't know how to explain that.
Yeah. Now, when you said earlier that they are dropped, could you elaborate more on that? When you think they're dropped, do you think they're – how would they – pick these things up? You know, these are cows,
well,
and if it was a helicopter.
You know, I don't want to point the incriminating finger in any particular direction. You know, they could be little green men from Mars doing it with flying saucers, or it could be Uncle Sam with clandestine helicopter crews. We have, you know, well over 350 reports of helicopters in and around mutilation sites over the years since the 70s. So, you know, if you compare the amount of helicopters that have been reported around a mutilation site and compare it to UFOs, it's like, UFOs are a fraction compared to helicopter reports. Now, whether they're able to actually lift, let's say, a 2,200-pound Simmental bull, you know, or it's much easier to lift a 300- or 400-pound calf than it is to, you know, obviously lift a full-grown, especially male, bull. So whether helicopters are the primary delivery system for this particular agenda, I really don't know. I just don't think it's by accident that we've had hundreds of helicopters sighted around mutilation sites during waves where these cases are being reported.
Now, speaking of waves, the strong one was back in the 70s, and why do you think there are waves? Let me just ask this. Do waves, did they happen the same time another type of strange event was happening, say, in the environment or anything like that?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we have all sorts of correlations, and I go into great detail along with the excellent research help of my mentor, David Perkins, who's been involved in this mystery for almost 40 years. We did go back, and we did look at how, not only how the waves began, unfolded, and ended, but also how the theories to explain the waves began, unfolded, and were promulgated or disseminated out into the culture. So we're looking at this from several angles. One is from a physical science angle. Here we have a mystery leaving behind thousands of pounds of potential physical evidence. We're looking at it from a cultural point of view, the belief in these things happening and how that belief affects the culture. And we're also looking at it in how this particular mystery seems to dovetail with other attendant phenomena like hairy hominids, the before-mentioned UFOs and helicopters, also outbreaks of rustling and cattle being shot. Tend to be the presage events that happen before a wave begins, for instance.
Really?
In the 70s, we had hundreds of animals being reported as rustled in Iowa, in parts of Nebraska in 71, later in 74, 75, prior to then unfolding waves of mutilation reports. So it's almost like back in the early days, before this became a national or an international news story, they were trying out different, modus operandi. They were saying, well, if we do this, what'll happen? If we do it this way, what'll happen? And I go to great lengths with, again, with David's very, very important assistance in identifying how the waves began, how they unfolded, how they ended, and how the attendant phenomenon, whether it be crypto creatures, black panthers, hairy hominids, flying 55-gallon drums flying in formation in one case that just still makes me scratch my head. it's a huge Gordian knot, and you have to unravel each thread at a time and look at the interrelatedness between all these things.
Yeah. Well, we have a bunch of questions just coming in on our chat room, but one thing comes to mind. This is really something that it's out there. It cannot be denied. Has anyone taken this serious enough to do a deep investigative report scientifically or anything like that?
Absolutely. The National Institute for Discovery Sciences, NIDS, who are the Robert Bigelow, the billionaire real estate guy who is the only person on the planet with his own private space station, he bought the Sherman Ranch up in Utah. And one of the things that they had to deal with was the cattle mutilation mystery. And they did a number of very, very well done scientifically peer-reviewable papers that look at various aspects of this particular mystery. There have been some feeble attempts by official groups to look into this and that have been, shall we say, highly suspect in their agendas in how the results were obtained and what the results were.
Sounds like UFO reports. UFO.
Yeah, it very much so. Yeah. But when you really look at all the different databases that I was able to collect that have been existing kind of stovepipe style alongside one another, nobody's ever brought them all together. And when you bring all these databases together, what really jump out are some of the veterinary pathology examinations that were very well documented by Iowa University. Dr. Waterhouse, for instance, attempted to duplicate some of the surgery-style wounds that were found and found it very, very difficult. He's a world-class veterinary pathologist and surgeon.
Wow.
He was very impressed with some of the work. We've had a number of workups on, you know, potential constituent elements within the animal. We found ketamine in other tranquilizers, barbiturates. In one case in Arkansas, I think they even found mescaline in one case. Another case had PCP in it.
Would this have anything to do with groundwater or anything like that? You know,
These are probably substances that were introduced intravenously into the animal.
That is really bizarre. A question up on the board here. When you interviewed the ranchers, what did they think caused these mutilations?
Well, you know, it's interesting. Just the whole examination of how the ranching community responds to these cases should be a whole book in itself. Most of the time, the higher strange, the weirder the case, the less likely the rancher is to report it to law enforcement or to neighbors or to the media. It's only the cases that really come across as provoking them to a place of indignation where they would report a case is when they see helicopters or when they see strange lights that appear conventional but they can't explain. It's when they think they're being victimized by other humans that ranchers tend to report these cases. When if it's some sort of heebie-jeebie thing or some preternatural predator that's taken their cow and left behind incredible evidence at the scene, those are the cases that they're more likely to just drag off and bury or throw in a bone pile and forget about. So ranchers, you know, they know what they're looking at. I mean, they're professionals in that their livelihood depends on how well they're able to ascertain the health and well-being of their animals and figure out what's wrong when an animal dies. And they've all seen, you know, 2% of their herd dies every year. I mean, that's just a statistical fact. And they've seen hundreds of dead animals over their careers as ranchers, and in some cases, third, fourth, fifth generation ranchers. So they know what they're looking at. And for the debunkers to say, oh, they don't know, you know, they don't know their ass from a hole in the ground when it comes to looking at a dead cow. It's like, sorry, they do. Mm-hmm. And I think most ranchers suspect a more homespun, down-to-earth, less mundane perpetrator, a la some sort of environmental monitoring by humans, let's say, possible in a few rare cases, intimidation by other ranchers. Occasionally, when it's really high strange and they get TV cameras in their face or a reporter there, And if they might be looking for a little publicity, they might use aliens or ETs as a possibility. Of course, Linda Howe and other investigators have really done a great job of promoting the cases where the ranchers say this. But for every rancher that thinks it's aliens doing this, I'll bet you there's 10, 20, 30 ranchers that think it's something way more down home and homespun.
You know, I never thought about the fact that, like UFO sightings, maybe a lot of people do not report them. Something I never thought of, but let's do the numbers here. Do you know approximately how many reported cases there are in, let's just say, the U.S.?
Well, it's a very difficult number to determine accurately, garbage in, garbage out. But based on my analysis and the analysis of David Perkins, we figure at least 10,000 official reports have been filed claiming that a head of livestock or more has been found in a mutilated condition.
Wow. Wow, that's something else. Another question up on the board. Do catamulated...
Now, that's just the U.S. Now, we're not even talking about Australia, England, South America.
Yeah. Well, this question is going to tie into that is, do cattle mutilations take place primarily in the U.S., or do they take place in other countries as well? That was up in the chat room.
Yeah, well, cattle mutilations are fairly consistent, a North and South American, and in some cases in Australia. But in terms of livestock, swine, sheep, especially horses, those kinds of cases have been reported all over in Christian countries. The earliest known documented case that I've been able to uncover was in 1606 in England around London, and in the official journal of James the First in the court of James, there is mention of a series of hundreds of sheep mutilations in and around London in the fall of, I think, 1605 and into the spring of 1606. So this is not something that you can just pin on the U.S. government or some nefarious conspiratorial explanation. Obviously, these types of forces weren't in operation back in 1605 and 1606. So, you know, we have cases from the early 1800s, cases from the late 1800s, the turn of the century. There was a whole spate of sheep mutilations in Australia around 1904, 1905, and again in 1920. Since 2002, we've had over 3,000 approximate cases in South America and Brazil, Argentina, and a few elsewhere down there. So we've had cases in, you know, Puerto Rico, the Canary Islands, Mexico. You know, the list goes on. And that's just the livestock now. We've also had, you know, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of domesticated cats have been found in half, cut in half, like with a giant pair of scissors, have been reported in most of the urban centers in the western United States. We had 50 dolphins with identical wounds wash up dead in France. We had seals in the Orkney Islands, way at the beyond the northern parts of Scotland, way up there, washing ashore with these strange spiral removals of blubber and flesh. The heads are gone and the spirals would go all the way down the body with no possible explanation for what could have done it. Nothing natural, not a ship's propeller. And when you start finding more and more of these seals washing up, you're going to wonder what the heck's going on.
Wow.
So this is not exclusively cattle. Cattle, I think it's safe to say, make up at least 90% of these cases of this type. But almost every warm-blooded animal you could name, including people, have been found in this condition. Deer, elk, buffalo, you know, the list goes on.
Wow, wow. And it just makes it more and more mysterious when you add up all that. Let's see. Lee wants to know, have there been any discoveries regarding excision locations and hormones?
Hormones? No. That's a little too broad of a question. In terms of, you know, what do you mean in terms of hormones? No, but we have had some pretty interesting cases that seem to target the fastest regenerating tissues in the body. You know, the organs that we as humans get cancer in most often, for instance, tend to be targeted. And out of all the theories that I've ever heard, and there are a bunch, the one theory that still stands the test of time, in my estimation, is the environmental monitoring theory that was first thought up by David Perkins back in 78, 79. He noticed that areas of high incidence of livestock mutilations tended to be downwind and downstream of the Nevada test site, where we mine uranium, where we enrich it, where we weaponize it, where we use it in power plants, and where we put it in missiles underground in missile silos. If you go downwind and downstream on the drainage in river systems, that's where the highest concentration of cases are found. I don't think that's by accident. And I also find it very interesting that you have clustering of cases in the wildlife. Chronic wasting disease breaking out and mutilation regions being around where we've maybe toyed around with bacteriological weapons development. So in terms of hormones, the only thing I know about hormones is don't pay her. in terms of cattle, you know.
Okay. Hey,
I couldn't resist.
I think that was one of the better ones. let's see. Now you threw me my question. My yeah. question's gone. Now, you mentioned earlier.
That's my job, bro.
You mentioned earlier, Christian. What do you think the tie-in is with Christian? And before I go on that, someone was screaming on, well, they use caps on the message board. How many people have been mutilated? And I want to add to that, what type of mutilating is it? Is it similar?
How many people have been mutilated? Well, I think humans have probably mutilated more humans over the millennia in various ways, whether it's witchcraft trials, inquisitions, warfare, sadism. Every day, humans are mutilated in Africa, in some of the third world countries. There's horrific cases. If you're all you have to do is just do a quick Google search, and you'll find mutilation cases that will really bother you.
They yeah, there's a show the called Dexter, too, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Called Dexter.
Yeah.
We also have ritual animal sacrifice that happens you know, hundreds of thousands of times a day. People sacrifice animals to various gods every day on this planet.
I believe that.
So in terms of the human cases, they are the most, I think, difficult to investigate, obviously. Law enforcement puts a lid on them. There's a total press and media blackout on these cases. A number of very, very good investigators, including ex-law enforcement, have looked into this whole scenario and have come up against a brick wall. I think these cases are very rare. When they do happen, they are by far the most scary cases for law enforcement to deal with, and they put the lid down big time on them.
I can totally understand that. Getting back to Christian countries where these things happen, why do you suppose that is?
I don't know. Why do you suppose that the sacred cow of India, the Brahma, has never been once reported as being mutilated? I have not, in all the thousands of cases in case history and reports, I have not one Brahma mutilation.
Wow. How about other places? How about other?
India is the largest exporter of beef. Yeah, most of your listeners probably don't know that.
No.
There are a lot of cows in India and buffalo, which is what they usually slaughter and export as beef. But Brahma cattle are one of the purest purest bred breeds of cattle on the planet. And they're still to this day held as sacred in India. And if you look at all the Brahmas around the world, you know, they've propagated. There's 940-something breeds of cattle that represent 1.37 billion head of cattle on the planet. They're the largest source of why we're cutting down the rainforest. They're the biggest cause of deserts, the largest contributor to freshwater pollution. They're one of the largest contributors to ozone-depleting gas. Cows burp and fart once every 2 minutes. Times that by 1.37 times, you know, how many minutes in a day.
You can almost hear them now. Hey, after I'm listening to you, you know, it kind of makes someone want to go vegetarian, really. You know,
well,
someone was saying that on the message board.
I love beef. I don't eat it very often. I love bison as my red meat of choice. I am very careful about where I obtain meat in general.
I like to get local, grass-fed, you know, cage-free, if you will. You pay more, you eat less, but you really you aren't playing Russian roulette with your health.
Yeah.
If the average listener out there had any idea what it took for that animal to be born and then end up as a slab of meat or ground meat on a piece of styrofoam wrapped in plastic in your grocery store, if you knew what it took to get that animal from A to Z into your grill, chances are you would think twice every time that you put you know, a juicy steak on the Barbie.
Yep. No, I've watched, there was a documentary all about that. Yeah. And
80% of the antibiotics used in this country go into cattle.
Mm.
I think 40 or 50% of the growth hormones go into cattle.
And it all goes into us, and on it goes.
You want to talk hormones? There you go. Why are little girls getting you know, to puberty at 8 and 9 years old?
Yep. It's in the milk. It's in all, right. That's right. Let's see.
I cover all this in the book, by the way.
Yes, you do. And there was a question I was just trying to get to on here. I'm sorry, I missed it. So getting back to the UFO, because this is a UFO show, getting back, I almost forgot about that. Well, how many, what type of percentage of cattle mutilations are involved in what they would say orbs or people saw a sighting, you know, close to or after?
Right, undefined lights, let's say.
Uh-huh.
Or, you know, some sort of light phenomenon, or let's say pod marks on the ground or swirled grass, that sort of thing. Very small percentage. Very small.
Really?
Yeah. Maybe 10%, if even that. I mean, that's being generous.
Mm-hmm. Yet a lot of people, I mean, I have thought and wondered if it had something to do with UFOs over the years, and I think a lot of people do. So there's kind of a misconception as far as that goes?
Well, I mean, the popular theory is that aliens are coming down, they're experimenting on cattle, taking organs for some sort of hybridization project. They need the genetic material. Well, if that's the case, why sneak around in little ranches around the world? Why not just break the lock on a rendering plant, go in, and you have as much genetic material as you could possibly ever need? It doesn't make sense to me. What makes sense is not so much the animal that's taken. It's where the animal exists in the environment that is the key. Okay, and if that's the case, then all this talk about genetic modification and gathering genetic material, it doesn't make any sense.
Right, right.
Period.
Now, you know, someone had asked earlier, is this a black ops, you know, situation that we're just not going to know what's going on? Is that...
Okay, well, how about this? Let's say, Marty, mad cow disease was part of a lab experiment to try to come up with a new bioweapon. What would happen if that disease escaped into the environment? It would get into the wildlife first, more than likely deer and elk, which it did in 1967, and then it would slowly start to spread. Now, what would you want to do? You would want to try to monitor the herds and the wildlife to ascertain the extent of the spreading potential pandemic. Well, let's say that it got into cattle herds. It's a species crosser. It can cross over the species barrier, and it went from deer and elk into cattle. Wouldn't you want to, like, make sure that you knew how it was spreading? And because you were the one responsible for letting it loose in the first place, you wouldn't want to tell anybody. You wouldn't want anybody to know. So you'd be sneaking around testing the environment for the potential spread of environmental contaminants or health-related contaminants. So is there a black budget, black ops thing going on? I would say, yeah, the chances are that that's a significant part of the scenario, not the entire part. It's okay. Been going on since way before we started to weaponize transmissible spongiform encephalopathy.
Yeah.
Potentially, hypothetically.
Well, I can't believe how fast the time has gone tonight. I mean,
whoa.
It really has. It's been flying. Yeah. So can you tell the listener out there, well, where they'd find you online and also where they'd find your book?
Well, I am the host, co-host of the Paracast, one of your top shelf radio shows covering the paranormal. And that's theparacast.com, P-A-R-A-C-A-S-T.com, with a T-H-E in front of it, theparacast. My website is ourstrangeplanet.com. It is a strange planet. It's ourstrangeplanet.com. And I also have a website set up under construction for the book, stalkingtheherd.com. And, you know, people, you got to get yourselves up to speed. You can't watch TV, listen to shows like this, and get all your information. You have to do the research. You have to be motivated enough to actually do the work and come to an informed decision and opinion of your own.
Very good. Well, thanks so much. I really appreciate talking to you. And, well, maybe we'll have you back on sometime. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah, cool. Looking forward to it, Marty. Thanks for having me on.
You bet. Well, that's it for our show. If you missed any part of the show, you can catch it as a podcast and a whole bunch of other free podcasts on our website, which is podcastufo.com. Also, you can check out our links and our stories to our show notes. You usually can, but, you know, here I am reading, and we don't really have any links in our show notes this week. Sorry about that. I want to thank everyone for helping out with the show today, our guest, of course, and Keith Rowland, the producer of the Dark Matter Radio Network, Andy Fleming for our astronomy look, Carrie Lloyd Whitehouse for the music, and Peggy Shunning, who manages our very busy and active Facebook page. And remember to like us on Facebook for all your UFO news and astronomy news. You can check us out right here next week at the Dark Matter Radio Network and every Wednesday at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And don't forget to jump in the chat room. This is Martin Willis reminding you to keep your eyes to the sky and your curiosity high. We'll see you next week.